Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You know what we need? We need some smart entrepreneur out there to come up with an app so the NSA can just pay me for my data. A market-based approach to big data on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Netflix Instant Streaming. Thousands of TV episodes and movies on your computer or mobile device instantly streamed by Netflix to save you time, money, and hassle. Free 30-day trial now at netflix.com/APM.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, and this is the podcast for the 17th of June. Glad to have you with us. Edward Snowden, the man the American government would really like to get its hands on right about now, keeps on making news. He did a live chat today with the Guardian newspaper in which he defended his leaking of those NSA documents a week or so ago. And there is no shortage of layers to this story, no shortage of ways to get at it, including this one. If it's our data the government is using, why can't anybody figure out a way to pay us for it? Computer scientist Jaron Lanier thinks about that very problem quite a bit. His most recent book on the topic is called Who Owns the Future? Jaron Lanier, good to have you with us.
I am delighted to be here.
Did this revelation of the NSA programs and PRISM and all that, did that surprise you at all?
Well, the details are tremendously surprising to me. I mean, after all, just to be clear, I'm not representing Microsoft, but I am a researcher in Microsoft's labs, and I would have expected to have heard about something like this, and I have to tell you, it was a total shock. On the other hand, what we've heard has not been entirely consistent. It doesn't make sense yet, and it's very hard for people to articulate what software does. So it might be that the impression we're getting about what's been leaked is actually not quite accurate. So I think we all have to be a little patient to learn about what exactly is going on. But I'm riveted. I'm really interested.
I wonder, though, if you, as a computer scientist, as something of a futurist, I don't know if you call yourself that, but as a guy who's been thinking about this stuff for a long, long time, isn't this the natural progression of things? Could this not have been foreseen?
Well, the odd thing is that it was foreseen. You know, this is what we're facing right now. If you want to have laws and judges and lawyers define in advance what not to do with a computer, if you want to tell the NSA what not to do, some programmer will always come up with some clever way around it. But if information costs money, that's really a general solution. That creates a more moderate usage of information that might create, a middle class, might create more benefits for more people. And I think we really need that.
Let's use me then as an example to try to figure out how this might work in real life, because obviously there are market mechanics problems here. I make a phone call. The government hoovers up that data, the NSA, whoever it is. It gets that data. It's mine. I am the sole provider of my telephone use data, right? It's mine. How does the government pay me? Do I get a check for 3.5 cents from the NSA twice a week?
Hell yeah. Absolutely.
Wow. All right.
Now, the thing about this, believe me, I don't know all the answers here. But basically, I think what we should do is we should have a market for information where prices are set by market forces and the government has to pay a market rate and people can be specialized. There might be one person who actually does make a lot of money because they're popular on social networking. Why not? It's entertainment. And there might be somebody else who just happens to like walking around town so much that the government thinks they're a great subject to study in terms of safety of sidewalks and whatnot. And maybe they'll make some money from that. And once again, why not? It's information that wouldn't exist if the people didn't exist. This is an attempt to find a path to having some sense of individual self-determination and not have lives run by a committee, even when the machines get really, really good.
Where does this go? What's the next logical progression? Assuming, and I apologize if I offend you, but assuming that we don't come up with a market-based solution for data, what happens?
I have to say, given the way the internet is, when somebody says I might offend you, I'm expecting something quite a bit more more spicy than that these
days.
That was
a little tame. I apologize.
You know, the way I see it, in terms of the options that have been articulated right now, we either enter into a world where we accept a huge class division that is set by how close you are to a giant computer, And then another option is socialism, where you have giant social programs to compensate for all the people who are thrown out of work because we refuse to take account of all that they contribute and the information they produce. Or we try to actually create a market economy with information and try to persist in this interesting experiment of balancing markets and democracy that has produced the best results in human history, so far as I can tell. And I'd really like to explore this third option. I think it's the best one on the table.
Jaron Lanier is a computer scientist. He's also a writer on a whole bunch of things. His most recent book is called Who Owns the Future? Mr. Lanier, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you again. It's great to be here.
You remember we were talking about volatility in the markets on the show on Friday, me and Catherine Rampell from The Times and Carney? Yeah, it's still happening. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're getting to that point in the Supreme Court's term where the cases and the questions they present are getting really interesting. The biggies this year about same-sex marriage and affirmative action are yet to come. But there was a ruling today that's worth a minute or two, I think. Let's say I invent some amazingly successful drug, make zillions of dollars from it. But sadly for me, it's about to go off patent and into that place where generics can come in and sell their versions. Can I pay a generic drug maker to not do that? Pay him to just sit on the sidelines and let me extend my profits? Today, the Supreme Court said deals like that can, at the very least, be challenged. From Washington Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
The Federal Trade Commission brought this case to the Supreme Court, and it declared victory today. It argued that more and more brand-name drug companies buy off generic makers to delay competition. That costs consumers $3.5 billion a year in pricier drugs, the FTC argued. Scott Hemphill at Columbia Law has advised the FTC in the past.
The end of pay-for-delay settlements will have a beneficial effect for consumers by bringing generic drugs to market sooner.
Now, the ruling doesn't end fishy settlements. It just lets them be challenged. Still, that is notable to Michael Carrier at Rutgers Law School. He says for years, courts leaned in favor of innovation and drug developers and cared less if they played fair.
Antitrust had not only been ignored, but kicked to the side of the stage so much so that it was almost off the stage.
Now, wouldn't it be great if pay-for-delay cases were obvious? Not so much. Damian Conover at Morningstar says the line between egregious deal and not so egregious is fuzzy.
There's definitely shades of gray, and black and white really doesn't come up in the patent law for drugs most of the time.
He says today's upshot could be more litigation and less certainty. Maybe that's why drug company stocks didn't move much after the ruling. And some think it'll drive drug companies to disguise pay-for-delay deals, to give money for inventory reimbursement or marketing. As one analyst put it, I still think the world is very full of smart lawyers. No dissent. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Mayor Michael Bloomberg wants New York City to be a greener place to live. He's got bike lanes and bicycle sharing already, with a couple of hiccups along the way, it must be said. Now he wants New Yorkers to start composting their trash. It's voluntary, the New York program is, but KQED's Arti Shahani points out that cities on the West Coast have been doing it for years.
Seattle is composting because citizens demanded it. Hans Van Dusen is with Seattle Public Utilities. He says 5 years back, only homeowners had to hire a service to process organic waste. Then renters began pushing to compost too.
The tenants were definitely interested in making sure that the service was available to them in apartments. And many owners were looking at it as an option, but maybe not moving as expeditiously as some of their tenants would want.
So a few years ago, Seattle passed a law requiring building owners to do it too. San Francisco also has mandatory composting laws. Waste Management Incorporated is a private company that handles organic waste for several cities in the Bay Area. Project manager Rebecca Jewell says composting is easy when you balance the ratio of protein to carbon.
Then you have the right chemistry and you cut down on the wet factor, which is going to attract roaches.
So New Yorkers, you can take that paper towel, which provides carbon, kill the roach, and add it all to the compost. Two problems solved. Besides roaches, New York is also full of sky-high apartment buildings. Jewel says that makes it hard to know which neighbors are guilty of mixing glass with chicken bones.
you have your hypothesis, but then what are you going to do? You're going to stalk them? You're going to put up a camera in the trash area? And that's where sometimes, yes, in fact, because recycling and compost can make people crazy.
She says education and patience are key. Seattle and San Francisco do not fine residents who fail to compost. Instead, they hand out liner bags. Composting doesn't take sticks so much as carrots. I'm Aarti Shahani for Marketplace.
President Obama's over in Northern Ireland today at the G8 summit of the world's wealthiest countries. Syria, of course, will be talked about. Tax evasion, as we mentioned on Friday. And something that goes by the entirely unremarkable initials, TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or in English, a U.S.-European free trade zone. Talks will start next month, but only because negotiators finally agreed to a French ultimatum that their system of subsidies and quotas for French movies and music were non-negotiable. From the European Desk Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
For the French, a famous victory. Bernard Aimier, French ambassador to Britain, says that Europe's cultural industries must not be exposed to the full force of transatlantic competition.
We just think that culture is not a commodity and that cultural diversity should be protected in Europe.
He defends the $1 billion a year his government ploughs into its film industry.
It's extremely important to have subsidies, to have support, I mean, in order that there is a vibrant cultural production.
And he cites the silent French movie The Artist as proof that subsidies work, made with public money, it won 5 Oscars. But the director denounces the French system of movie finance, and so does Sylvain Charras.
The subsidy system do not guarantee quality. It guarantees only an income for movie producers or actors or artists.
Charras, a former French government official, claims most French movies are rather dismal. The industry would be better off without state support. Much of the subsidy, he says, goes into paying inflated salaries. Take Vincent Cassel, who played the bullying ballet instructor in the Hollywood movie Black Swan.
Seduce us! Attack it! Attack it! Come on!
Hollywood paid him $300,000 for that role. The movie grossed $250 million. But in the subsidized French movie industry, Cassel was paid vastly more for this.
J'ai pas envie d'être l'esclave à perpétuité de mon réveil matin.
He got $2 million, while that movie, Mezrine, grossed barely $30 million. Perhaps the most telling indictment of the French subsidies, says Charras, is that Hollywood couldn't care less about them. Jim Killick, a trade attorney with law firm White and Chase, is not surprised.
There's a lot of Hollywood films do very, very well in France and Belgium, all around Europe.
In France, Europe's biggest cinema market, only 4 of the 20 most popular films last year were French. Most of the others were American and, of course, unsubsidised. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Seems like every time immigration policy comes up, we wind up talking about one very specific kind of visa. They're called H-1Bs for highly skilled workers, mostly but not always in high tech. Last April, companies, again mostly but not all high tech companies, filed H-1B applications so fast they hit the annual quota of 65,000 of them in just a matter of days. The immigration bill that the Senate is debating right now would almost double that number. But as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports, just having the visa doesn't solve all the problems.
Good morning, Evantage Technologies. How may I direct your call?
Evantage Technologies is a small consulting and software company in New Jersey. The company uses H-1B visas when it needs highly specialized tech workers it says it can't find in the U.S. Usually the process goes off without a hitch, but about 10% of the time, there's a problem. A big problem. The person hired doesn't show up, which leaves Evantage CEO Satya Pulavarapu shaking his head.
Yeah, where is this person? And sometimes, I mean, when we send emails or, tries to call them, there would be no response.
Deadlines on important projects have to be pushed back because of the no-show. And Polavarapu loses the thousands of dollars he spent hiring the H-1B worker.
$6,000 in direct cost.
The costs of H-1B visa filing fees and attorney's fees. Polavarapu never finds out what happened to the H-1B worker he hired, but chances are the person is working for another U.S. tech company. Some foreign workers with very specialized skills apply for more than one H-1B visa job. They get a number of offers and never contact the companies they reject.
It's a burden. Also, it makes you rethink your strategy.
Polavarapu's strategy now? He does all interviews in person or on Skype to try to get to know the people he's hiring, but also because of another H-1B problem, the ringer. Not that kind of ringer. I'm talking about an imposter, somebody who's highly qualified, who does an interview on behalf of an H-1B job applicant who's not qualified and is often overseas. The ringer wows the interviewer, and the unqualified applicant is hired. It happened to Kevin Raffay, a contract programmer who helps staff up projects for tech companies. He interviewed a ringer and told his boss, hire that guy. He was surprised when a very inexperienced programmer showed up.
The candidate that I recommended had good communication skills and was technically sound. This person had very poor communication skills and was very junior as far as his technical capabilities.
Now, Raffay stresses this happened at the height of the dot-com boom, before Skype. Ringers were a lot more common then, but they're still out there. Just Google proxy interviewer if you want to find one. Raffay says some even advertise and set a price.
I'll take your interview for $30. You know, you're talking about half hour time to answer some questions for somebody who's not able to answer them.
These reports of H-1B visa fraud are starting to get the attention of bigger companies. David Rutschick is a partner at Pace Harmon, a large outsourcing advisory firm just outside Washington. He tells clients looking to hire an H-1B visa worker,
you want to do everything you can do. You want to validate. You want to get all the transcripts. You want to check references. You know, if you don't have a rigorous hiring process, then sort of shame on you and you put yourself at risk by not doing so.
Rutschick has also noticed the government is making employers jump through more hoops to get an H-1B visa, possibly, he says, to prevent fraud. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up, ladies and gentlemen, you are not free to move about the cabin.
The slimline seats will probably give you about the same amount of legroom. Will it be more comfortable? I don't think so.
Yeah, no. But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street took the high road while it waits for that Fed meeting tomorrow and Wednesday. The Dow Industrials rebounded 0.75% today, 109 points, closed at 15,179. The NASDAQ jumped 0.8%, 28 points, finished at 3452. The S&P 500 tipped up 0.75%, 12 points, 1639 at the bell. Some decent news on home builder confidence and other economic activity also gave stocks a lift today. Morgan Stanley ascended 1.5%. JP Morgan Chase added about 1.25%. Despite the surveillance mess, tech stocks had nothing to hide. Microsoft clicked up 1.75%. Facebook packed on more than 1.5%. Google scored about an extra 1.25% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.18%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Netflix Instant Streaming. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your computer, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. Streamed now by Netflix, a great value. Netflix Streaming has lots of movie and television options, including past seasons of House of Cards, Breaking Bad, and Arrested Development. Watch them using Netflix Instant Streaming and find thousands of other TV series and movies during your free 30-day trial at netflix.com/APM.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for May. Are consumers experiencing inflation in their day-to-day living expenses? The Labor Department releases its monthly Consumer Price Index. And I don't know if the fish appreciate this one, but some foodies celebrate International Sushi Day. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. If you know a brand new college graduate, or really, even if you don't, you're probably familiar with the trouble that young people are having finding jobs in this economy. That problem is even more pronounced in the world's second biggest economy, where a record 7 million Chinese are graduating from college and university this spring, only half of whom can find work. Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz swung by a job fair in Shanghai.
Hundreds of HR managers carefully eye prospective employees, resumes in hand, who crowd the floor at a Shanghai job fair. Here's the problem. Neither group is interested in each other. Nicole Lee is looking to hire college graduates for her property management company.
We need technicians to fix software problems, but college grads don't have these skills. We need people for exhibitions who can do presentations in English, but they can't do that either.
Lee needs to hire people for 60 high-skilled jobs. She says among the thousands of candidates here today, she'll be lucky if she finds one. Tong Huiqin comes to this job fair every Friday. He graduated from the Shanghai Finance University 6 years ago. Since then, he's jumped from one job to the next.
It isn't hard to find a job. It's hard to find the right job.
He's worked as a supervisor for a bunch of companies, but hasn't found the right fit.
You could have 500 graduates and 500 job openings here. None of them would match up.
Tong blames Chinese universities. He says they need to do a better job at preparing people for the country's rapidly changing labor market. Xiong Binqi is the deputy dean of the 21st Century Education Research Institute, a nonprofit think tank in Beijing.
The scale of China's higher education system has developed so fast that we're failing to produce college graduates with the right skills for the jobs that are out there.
For those with means, that's meant sending your college-age children instead to universities in the U.S., Australia, or Europe. But most young Chinese can't afford that, so they're stuck in a Chinese university. And after they graduate, their unemployment rate is four times higher than for those who didn't get past elementary school. Inside the job fair, young graduates linger in front of a booth for Bao Steel, China's largest steel manufacturer. A big sign says that people from parts of Sichuan, Henan, Anhui, and Hunan are not allowed to apply. A guy applying for a job tells me people from those provinces can't be trusted. It's sort of like a booth at a New York job fair banning applicants from, say, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and North Dakota. But this is typical in China, where even state-owned enterprises don't bother to hide their discrimination. At a neighboring booth, Jason Zhang's hiring people to work at a chain of nightclubs. He doesn't care where his job candidates are from. He's more concerned whether they're willing to work.
I think graduates today are less appealing than people who were born in the 70s and 80s. They tend to be overly confident and don't want to really work that hard.
I turn around and ask 22-year-old Wang Qianmin, who's about to graduate from Shanghai Normal University with a teaching degree, what she's looking for at the job fair.
I don't know. Most of the jobs here aren't really interesting. I'm looking for a company that'll give me a high salary, money for meals, and that'll pay my rent, a place where the working hours aren't too long.
Wang tells me she wants to be a teacher or a wedding planner. She can't decide. Jason Zhang, the recruiter, has years of experience hiring people, rolls his eyes at this type of candidate.
Chinese college graduates these days think they're really special. The problem is, they're the only ones who think that.
Zhang says Wang and many others in China's class of 2013 will go all summer thinking they've got lots of options and will probably end up unemployed. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
In its continuing quest to find out exactly how many people it can cram into the back of a long, skinny aluminum tube that flies through the air, American Airlines has some new economy class seating arrangements in store for the traveling public. More seats in its 737 and MD-80 jets, to be precise. American's not saying how many seats it will squeeze in or how it's going to do it. But Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports now from New York on how much that extra knee room means to the bottom line.
For airlines, seating is literally a game of inches. So let's pull out the tape measure. That's 31 inches, the smallest pitch on one of these short-haul American jets. Pitch is the distance between rows, that ever-shrinking zone where you can unfold your legs, maybe. To add seats, airlines have to squeeze rows a couple inches closer. You hear that tape measure shortening? Now we're under 30 inches, which only a handful of carriers have dared to try. So just how much is an inch worth? Aviation consultant Addison Schonland.
It's hard to tell what that inch is worth because it's going to vary by market, by time of day. It's very hard to come up with a generic number.
Even if airlines can't pinpoint the cost of an inch, they're very cautious about taking it away. It's hard to believe, but they're not trying to torture us. Aviation consultant Michael Boyd says new, thinner seats could let airlines have it both ways.
The slimline seats will probably give you about the same amount of legroom. Will it be more comfortable? I don't think so. But it's not as if they're turning airplanes into the 7th Avenue subway.
With food service and coach dwindling, airlines are also making room by ripping out kitchens. Now let's stretch the tape out to 6 feet 5 inches, the height of aviation consultant George Hamlin. Flying coach is never fun for him, but there's not much choice anymore.
Domestic economy has become pretty much of a commodity product.
So, tough luck if you don't like that tight seat on American. Other carriers are just as jammed. So if you can't pay to change the tail of the tape, you may just have to drive. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which I will begin by noting that President Obama and Russian President Vladimir Putin had what's being called a tense meeting about Syria on the sidelines of the G8 summit today. But that's really a sidebar to what I actually wanted to mention, which is that Putin is being accused of stealing a Super Bowl ring from Robert Kraft, the guy who owns the New England Patriots. First of all, what? And B, it turns out that Kraft gave the ring to Putin to look at when they met back in 2005, and Putin just put the thing in his pocket and basically walked away. C, again, what? All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow up 0.75%, 109 points. The NASDAQ up 0.8%, 28 points. The S&P 500 tipped up 0.75%, 12 points there. Our producers include Lina Anwar, Bridget Bodner, Mary Dew, Nancy Fargali, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Jolie Myers, and ciao, too. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.